I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A building in Baghdad blew up today in the course of a raid by U.S. troops searching for suspected production of chemical munitions, according to American Brigadier General Mark Kimmett. At least two soldiers were killed and five wounded. And after the explosion, exultant Iraqis looted U.S. military vehicles of weapons and equipment. Meanwhile, in Fallujah, there was a new burst of fighting today, despite U.S. efforts to extend a ceasefire through tomorrow. At his Baghdad press briefing today, General Kimmett played video of an outbreak of fighting as U.S. soldiers and Iraqi police moved through Fallujah, attempting to allow civilians to move around as well until shooting came, the general said, from the minaret of a mosque.
Again, another example. And this is what we get in return. This is a mosque being used by the enemy to fire at coalition soldiers. You can see the firing coming from the different windows. Sadly, we're getting more and more film of the latter rather than of the former.
We're joined now by Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor, who is in Fallujah. Hi, Scott.
How are you?
Scott, a very fluid situation where you are amid these continuing efforts to broker a ceasefire. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is that this is quite a long, prolonged firefight that took place that began just after 10 o'clock in the morning here and lasted at least 5 hours. I think what took many of the Marines by surprise was the fact that this was a very large and coordinated assault, especially, of course, we're meant to be in the middle of a ceasefire at the moment. But basically what happened today, according to the soldiers that I spoke to who actually took part in the fighting and were under attack, there were between 50 and 150 insurgents who basically took on their positions in a frontal way and then also in a frontal attack and then also moved around behind them to try and cut off their supply lines. So what they feel is that perhaps the last days of the ceasefire, those insurgents have been taking advantage of those to deepen their defenses and come up with better ways of beginning their offense.
Hmm. Now, Scott, we heard that gunfire said to be coming from a mosque's minaret. Return fire from U.S. troops reportedly damaged the minaret. Now, that's just the sort of thing that can inflame the population in Fallujah, no matter how necessary it may be to fire back at someone shooting at you, right?
Well, I think that's right, and this is, of course, the balance that the U.S. Marines that are meant to be controlling all of Western Iraq are dealing with every single day. We heard a lot of threatening rhetoric last week from U.S. Commanders saying that they were willing within days, not weeks, to seize total control of the city, choose a military option, if you will. But then I think in recognition of what the political and possible military backlash of that might be, we heard a lot of toning down over the weekend to the point where commanders were talking about allowing diplomacy to work a little bit more, talking about the need for a much more complex and fluid solution, that a military solution simply wouldn't work in this case. So I think that, but it's hard to know how today's fighting, which really was significant relative to what we've seen here in the last couple of weeks, it's hard to know how that's going to change or affect U.S. strategy.
Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us from the outskirts of Fallujah. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Google, the number one search engine on the Internet, is expected to announce one of the biggest initial public offerings ever this week. According to a Wall Street Journal report, Google has chosen Credit Suisse First Boston and Morgan Stanley to lead its IPO, an offering that some speculate will raise Google's worth to as much as $25 billion and make it more valuable than Lockheed Martin, Federal Express, and Nike. Well, joining us on the line is Declan McCullough. He's D.C. Bureau Chief for CNetNews.com. And Declan, Thursday is the deadline for filing, but there had been speculation that the two owners of the company would resist going public. Why would they resist going public?
If you go public, you lose some control of your company. You're under much more intense public scrutiny, and you might lose the whimsy that has characterized Google so far. I mean, on April 1st, for instance, they put up a fake, an April Fool's job ad for a Google Space Base, and that was just wonderful. But I'm wondering if things are going to become a little less whimsical and more serious after an IPO.
Well, what are the other pressures for them to go public?
The biggest pressure is, of course, their venture capital investors. This is a great time for Google to go public if it chooses to do so. The expected competition from Microsoft and Yahoo in the search engine environment hasn't materialized quite yet. Google's really at the top of its game, and so if they do an IPO soon, then Google's initial investors can get a tremendous return for their initial investment.
We understand that each of the two venture capitalists stand to make about an 800-fold return on their original investment of $25 million. But what about for the average investor?
Any Google IPO, if they choose to do it, could have wild swings up and down. I mean, this is not a company that has, say, 20 years of revenue, and it doesn't have quite that wide of a moat. This is Warren Buffett's phrase to talk about how secure companies are from new competitors. And so this may not be the best thing for small investors if you're looking at something to count on 20 years from now. At the same time, it would have been nice to get in on Microsoft at the beginning.
Well, we understand that Google will have to do something this week by Thursday because of securities and exchange laws.
That's right. Under federal law, a private company has to report its finances once it has more than 500 common shareholders, or in the case of Google, stock option holders, and at least $10 million in assets. Google meets both of those tests. And so by the end of this week, we'll know what Google's planning on doing. It could do the IPO that everyone's expecting, or it could just make the disclosure and say, we're moving towards an initial public offering.
Who stands to profit the most from this IPO?
Well, yeah, investment banks always do quite handsomely, although Google's reportedly trying to keep down some of the fees. Google's founders, and especially early employees, are going to be some of the biggest winners if this goes through. Although, keep in mind, under rules governing most IPOs, they can't cash in right away. They might have to wait something like 3 months or 6 months or a year before they can divest themselves of all their shares, and they may not want to.
Yeah. For the average investor, could you just speculate for us, what happens if, in fact, Google goes public on Thursday? Can someone put $10 in on Friday?
It'll be a longer period and a longer process than that. Google reportedly is trying to make this initial public offering a little bit more open to the general public than most are. I mean, so we don't know yet what they'll be doing. But if they do make it a bit more open a process, then perhaps you can get in on the IPO as easily as going to Google.com.
Hmm. Well, we'll wait and see. Declan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Declan McCullough, he's D.C. Bureau Chief for CNetNews.com.
As of May 17th, gay couples will have the right to marry in Massachusetts. But if the state's governor, Mitt Romney, has his way, that right will be limited to gay couples actually from the state of Massachusetts. Romney plans to enforce a little-known 91-year-old law which prevents marriage licenses to be issued if an out-of-state couple's marriage in Massachusetts would not be recognized in their home state. Michael Levinson and John McElhaney are covering the story for the Boston Globe. Michael Levinson joins us on the line in Boston. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Michael, tell us about this 1913 law.
All right. The 1913 law was passed in Massachusetts partly to deal with interracial marriage bans in other states. Mm-hmm. What the law says is that the state shall not marry anyone whose marriages would not be recognized within their own state. So the governor now has come in and said no other state besides Massachusetts recognizes gay marriage, therefore only couples from Massachusetts are allowed to marry.
Yet how firm's his legal footing? Only 38 states have laws prohibiting gay marriages, and some states, like New York, have said they would recognize gay marriages performed elsewhere.
You're right. It's caused quite a debate, and it's unclear what other jurisdictions might try and recognize gay marriages. As you mentioned, the New York Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, has said that his state would recognize marriages performed in Massachusetts. Likewise, the Seattle City Council has passed a local ordinance recognizing such marriages. So there's a lot of debate. Even our own Attorney General, Thomas Riley, has said that only those 38 states that have specific statutes protecting heterosexual marriage would be applicable under that 1913 law. So Romney has taken the broadest possible interpretation of that law.
What's he up to politically?
A lot of people say he's trying to use this issue to raise his national profile. It's an issue that obviously has resonance with conservative voters across the nation, and if Romney's looking to build a national profile for himself, this is a good way to get noticed in conservative constituencies.
Michael, should we expect legal challenges?
Absolutely. The gay rights advocates here in Massachusetts have said it's inevitable that this law is going to be challenged in court. A lot of the clerks that I spoke with said they're expecting it to be challenged as well.
Now, is there any institutional resistance to this? I'm thinking about justices of the peace who will be charged with marrying the couples.
That's right. Well, on Sunday, the governor's chief legal counsel, Daniel Winslow, spoke to the justices of the peace and told them they must perform same-sex marriages. That's part of their oath, and if they fail to do that, they could be sued for discrimination. That warning came after some of the justices had grumbled that they would not perform same-sex marriages because they're personally opposed. The governor's chief legal counsel clarified that that would be a violation of their oath and that they should sooner resign than withhold those marriage ceremonies.
Apart from the issue of couples from other states, we should expect gay marriages in Massachusetts on May 17th?
Absolutely. The governor himself, even though he's an opponent of gay marriages, says that as of May 17th, gay marriages are here. And barring some extraordinary circumstance where he would get the power to go before the Supreme Judicial Court and ask for a stay of the ruling, that's the law of the land in Massachusetts. So it's coming May 17th.
Michael, there's an economic dynamic to this, too, isn't there? Banning couples from other states from coming to Massachusetts to be married, well, that means they won't be moving into hotels, they won't be buying flowers here, they won't be having receptions here.
Absolutely. I mean, if you push aside the moral, legal, and social issues, there's a giant economic benefit to gay weddings, and I doubt that anyone would question that. You know, caterers, florists, dress designers, hotels are very much looking forward to the start of gay marriages, especially in Provincetown and other areas that are very popular with the gay community. And it's a huge economic benefit.
But the governor seems willing to lose that.
I think for the governor, it's not an economic issue. He says it's a legal issue, and he's bound to uphold the law. So he's willing to forego whatever millions in benefit would come to the state.
Michael Levinson is covering the gay marriage story for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Boston. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Just ahead, thousands are in coalition custody in Iraq, held in detention centers. How are they being treated?
And later in the show, the enduring legacy of the Bronte sisters.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
UN Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, said last week that the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq is holding Iraqi detainees without charge or trial, an issue that needs to be addressed, he says, as Iraq's sovereignty is restored. But how are those detainees being treated? St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter Ron Harris was embedded with a unit of the Marines in western Iraq near the Syrian border. He heard rumors from the soldiers that detainees were being tortured, that their cries could be heard in the night. When he mentioned that to the officer in charge, he was challenged to go there and see for himself, so he did. Ron Harris brought back stories and pictures of what looked like tidy chicken coops to us. We asked him to describe them.
It's a large metal, like looks like a warehouse. And inside that warehouse, they built these wooden and wire, as you said, sort of like chicken coop, the holding facilities. And I guess they're 20 by 10 in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on one side of the facility. On another side, because they were having so much overflow, they had to very quickly build some others, which are actually fairly small. They're probably 8 by 5, and they keep two guys in there. They try to keep one person in there.
Well, what else is in there? It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell with the shadows. Are there beds or tables? What's in there?
Yeah, they have some cots that they sleep on, and they give them blankets. And that's pretty much it.
Well, how many detainees were there, and how did it feel to you? How did you feel that they were being treated?
It seemed like they were being treated just fine when I was there. They've got, the facility is very clean. It's very quiet. These people eat exactly what the Marines eat. They eat three meals a day. They eat a hot breakfast, an MRE for lunch, and a hot dinner. You get all this water. I mean, I can see all the water stacked up.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of, as a guy told me, they have a lot of ceremonial prayers. They use a lot of water for that. They wash their hands and wash their feet. And the Marines make all allowances.
Did you get to talk to any detainees?
This time, no.
UN Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, has said that the U.S.-led coalition is holding many of the detainees without charging them or giving them a fair trial. He's been critical of the way the U.S. is treating many Iraqi detainees. Did you see anything that would make you agree with that?
Of the detainees I saw, no. Be honest, no.
Mm-hmm.
The detainees that are kept there are not kept for long periods of time. So I looked at a chart of who was there, how long they'd been there, et cetera. And probably the average guy's been there 3 days. Because either they release you after that period of time or you're shipped somewhere else for a different interrogation.
Yeah.
The guys who are there go through some intense interrogation, particularly if they really think that this person is involved with something. And, I questioned the guy about physical abuse. I said, I'm hearing that the guys are screaming at night and they're going through a lot of pain and suffering. And he said, no, that's not happening. It's more perception than reality. And I talked to the guys who actually do the interrogation. They said, we can do two or three. According to the Geneva Convention, we can do a couple, so many things. And we are under very, very, very strict orders from our commander that we can't do certain things. Mm-hmm. And what they can do, and they say they do that, is they yell a lot and they scream at the guys. They pound on walls and they will use sleep deprivation. They like to use some other sort of euphemism, but that's what it is. They can do some things with rationing in which they cut down on the food that they give them. And they use all of those techniques. They do try to frighten them and give them the sense that they might do some physical harm to them. As one guy said to me, he said, look, if I'm actually pulling out your fingernails and causing you a lot of pain, you'll tell me anything, and that information is unreliable. He said, but if I can get your fear up and create a sense that if you don't tell me the truth, I'm going to ship you off to Guantanamo Bay tomorrow, then I can get you in a certain zone, keep you off balance, hear what you have to say, and then check that against some other information and see if I've got the truth.
Now,
I'm going to tell you, though, and the Marines didn't like to say it, from what I can tell, there are no guidelines across the board. There are no rules and regulations. For instance, the Marine 1st Division, they have very strict rules and regulations. But you don't have any rules and regulations that come from the Coalition Provisional Authority or rules that apply to the Marines and rules that also apply to the Army and a rule that also apply to the Bulgarian Army and a rule that also apply to whatever other or the British Army, except for the Geneva Conventions. So I found out, for instance, that these guys that were being held here before the Marines came in, and the Marines were very careful not to be critical of the Army. But see, as one guy told me, he said, these guys were being held in facilities that you couldn't even really sit down in. They had them in it was like these cages. It was barely room to turn around.
But we should just add, you didn't see those, right?
I didn't see those, no.
Right.
But some Marines, they said they saw them when they came in, and they took them down.
Hmm. One last question, Ron. One of the pictures that I'm looking at is a Marine escorting a detainee in a long robe and a very pointy hood. Huh?
Yep.
What's that?
That is two things. In some cases, for punishment, they might put a guy, they might put a hood on somebody's head.
So he can't
and
see.
And that's for like talking. You know, they tell you to stop talking, and the guy keeps talking. So I'll put the hood on his head for a while, and then they'll take it off. What they'll also do is when they bring, depending on who they are, they will, when they pick up prisoners or detainees from whatever location they put them, pick them up, they always either blindfold them or put on a one of those hoods. And the reason they do that is because they don't want the guys to know where the base is.
Well, Ron Harris, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Ron is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's just returned from Iraq, where he was embedded with the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines in western Iraq. He spoke to us on the line from Kuwait.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, continuing with the Iraqi detainee question, we asked the Coalition Provisional Authority about the rules for keeping someone in detention.
Also, jazz guitarist Bill Frisell. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush's image as a strong leader held steady in recent weeks, despite April's high death toll for American soldiers in the Iraq War, and despite alleged intelligence failures on his watch before 9/11. Presumptive Democratic nominee Senator John Kerry's ratings on leadership and decisiveness, on the other hand, slumped. In the Washington Post ABC News poll between March and April, Kerry's ratings as a strong leader dropped 9 points. His ratings as trustworthy and honest fell 10%. Here to discuss recent poll numbers and other weekend news from the nation's capital are Carl Lubsdorf, Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Bill.
And Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today.
Hi, Bill.
Andrea, what do you make of these polls?
I think this is a problem that John Kerry has had for his entire political career, as somebody who is, you know, seen perhaps as an opportunist who kind of looks which way the political winds are going. And, you know, I think that's a problem for him. And I think he's got a big problem in the next couple of weeks. The Boston Globe has been working on a biography of him, and I think there's going to be a lot of things that he's not going to like in there. He's going to have to deal with that in the next couple of weeks.
Carl, isn't it sometimes with Senator Kerry a question of nuance, whereas the president doesn't bother with the nuance?
I think that's right. I mean, President Bush sees the world often in very black and white terms. He's very direct. He's very punchy in what he says. And Senator Kerry gives the impression of someone who's always weighing different courses of action. That has certainly been true in his handling of the war in Iraq over the last couple of years. But that sometimes is harmful, because the public likes someone who stands up for what he believes in. And you see in the polls the numbers on, you know, that a lot of people think that Kerry is a waffler. The idea that the Bush campaign has started to push in its ads does seem to have taken hold to some degree.
And the Bush administration and the Bush campaign has spent tens of millions of dollars on ads to enhance that view of Senator Kerry. Staying with Senator Kerry, Andrew, this question of his medals. He has always said that in the 70s he threw away his ribbons from Vietnam, but not his medals. Now ABC News has come up with a recording of him saying he did indeed throw away the medals. More problems for Kerry?
I think so. I mean, I think he's been very unclear. He said that he's thrown away his ribbons, which you wear on the uniform as opposed to the big medals. He said he threw away a couple of other veterans' medals at the time. And, you know, Karen Hughes went on the Sunday shows and brought this issue up again. We're going to hear a lot more about Vietnam. MoveOn.org just today has a new ad comparing Kerry's service in Vietnam, where he was in combat, to President Bush, who was in the Air National Guard and never went overseas and didn't show up for his flight physical. So, you know, expect to hear a lot more about Vietnam and also the post-Vietnam era when Kerry came back and was one of the leaders of the anti-war movement.
Let's face it, what's going on here, one of the big assets Senator Kerry has in this election is his war service.
Right.
Despite the fact that he was critical of the war, he went and fought there, won some medals, was wounded, and came back and fought against the war and said it was, you know, that he was confirmed in his view. And the Bush campaign is really determined to tear that down and to muddy it up. They don't have a positive message in this case to show, since there's so many questions about President Bush's military service. So they're trying to nitpick at various things in the Kerry record. And Senator Kerry, as Andrea said, has not been totally forthright on it, but that's really not what this is about.
Andrea, one constituency that would seemingly be pro-Kerry, as many as a million people on the Mall in Washington this weekend, women marching for pro-choice and abortion rights. How important is that march to Senator Kerry and that constituency to Senator Kerry, or is this about the already converted being preached to?
I think this is the already converted. This was, as much as this was a pro-choice march, I think it was an anti-Bush march. This was the first abortion-related march in Washington in 12 years, and they're talking about, now, of course, crowd numbers are always subject to interpretation, but they're saying this is one of the biggest marches that Washington has ever seen. So I think just as for the left, or for the Democrats, abortion is a pivotal culture war issue, just like gay marriage is for Republicans, for conservatives. So, but I don't think there were too many, swing state type of people in this. This was a pro-Kerry group.
This was a huge march, Carl. Significance politically in your mind?
I agree with Andrea on that. I mean, intensity among the anti-Bush voters is important in terms of turnout, but there's been no shortage of that. The fact is that on the abortion issue, most elections that I've seen where among voters who say that that has been the vote determinant of the vote, actually more people seem to vote on the basis of being opposed to abortion than the end vote and who are pro-choice. The pro-choice voters tend to have other reasons that are factors. Now, as far as the substance of the march, this is a big issue in terms of the outcome of this election, because we say this every election, but this time it's really going to be true. The next president is going to appoint several Supreme Court justices, and that could very well turn the direction of the court on this issue.
You know, Carl, 9/11 hearings, the problems in Iraq and so on. April should have been a tough month for President Bush. I remember just a couple weeks ago talking about Bob Woodward's new book, Plan of Attack, before it came out. Many were suggesting that that might be a problem for the president. But the month's not turned out all that bad, including the book, right, which Karl Rove, the president's political advisor of all people, is urging people to read.
The White House wants to keep the focus on national security issues, even if things are going poorly over there. First of all, you know, their hope is that by fall they'll be going better. But they really have not wanted the election to be fought on domestic issues. But note of caution here, there has been some movement in the polls towards Bush, no doubt about it. But some of the underlying numbers are still pretty weak for him. His job approval is barely over 50%. And when people are asking whether the country is on the right track or the wrong direction, you know, in the upper 50s say it's going in the wrong direction. So I remember 4 years ago, Vice President Gore was having a tough time at this period, and everyone said, oh, he's losing the election now. So, you know, it may well be we'll look back, and this was the decisive period, but I think this election is going to be in doubt a good while longer.
Andrea, very briefly, it is indeed very early, isn't it?
It really is. You know, I think we're going month to month, and I think we have to wait till we get into the summer when we get to the conventions, and really, you know, like every election, voters really don't sort of tune in until after Labor Day.
You know, Andrea, you said we're going to have to keep watching this month to month. Fact is, these days we watch this stuff, it seems, hourly, and we'll continue
right.
to do it with both of you. Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today. Thanks, Andrea.
My pleasure.
And Carl Lubsdorf, Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Thanks, Carl.
Glad to be with you, Bill.
Thanks to you both.
Still to come, they wrote Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. They were superstars in the 1800s and still have a cult following today. The Bronte Sisters.
You're listening to Here and Now. Pizza. It's more than just food, you know. It's also, for true aficionados, culinary art, as is proven annually at the World Championships of Pizza Making. This year they were held appropriately in Italy, but it was an American who brought home top honors in one critical event. Joining us from his store in Kenton, Ohio, is that masterful pizza maker, Michael Shepherd. Michael, welcome.
Thanks.
Michael, you won a gold medal in the dough stretch. What the heck is that?
Well, it's one of the ability categories that they have. They not only bake pizzas in the competition, but they have what they call an ability category, where they have a largest pizza stretch. That's the one I won. A fastest pizza making competition, freestyle acrobatic, and a team acrobatic.
So you stretched out a pizza pie to some large circular size. We're not talking about just pulling dough here, right?
Right.
How big?
My stretch this time, the winning stretch, was 87.5 centimeters, which, of course, over there it's the metric system.
You'll do the math, I hope.
Yeah, roughly 34.5 inches.
34.5 inches, about a yard wide.
Right.
What are these world championships like? How many take part?
There's people from all over the world. I think there's 10 different countries there this year. You know, the U.S., Italy, Japan, Finland, Spain. The Czech Republic, France.
Who won the best tasting pizza this year? Do you remember?
Of course, it was an Italian.
It was an Italian.
Yeah. Well,
what's it like being an American pizza maker coming into Italy?
The odds are set up pretty much in their favor. The judging is predominantly all Italian judges.
How much training is involved in winning the World Championship of Dough Stretching?
I put a lot of practice into it.
I bet.
I figure, you know, if I'm going to go across the ocean and compete over there, well, I better know what I'm doing.
Now, in your typical day, are you one of these wonderful pizza makers that's spinning them in the air and all that kind of stuff around the ovens?
Exactly. Everybody here, we hand toss our pizzas, so everybody that works here that makes pizza has to be able to do that.
How hard is that to do? Is it one of those things that really takes a while to learn, or is it something you can pick up in a day or two?
It usually takes, you know, the new trainees, when they come in, it'll take them a good month to 6 weeks to get it down to where they're fairly, you know, competent at it, to actually get to go from a dough ball to a pizza. Now, to actually get it spinning in the air, doing any kind of extra tricks, that can take years.
I'm sure, with a lot of dough ending up on the floor, I bet, for that first month or so.
Yeah, exactly.
You must be, and you don't have to mention any brand names, but you must be a bit horrified about all the prepackaged pizza out there. It tastes different, right?
Yeah, you know, you can tell. You know, our customers come to us because they like our pizza, not because they like the price or that it's cheap or anything like that.
I bet a lot of them like to see the world champion dough stretcher at the height of his art.
Yeah, we get a lot of people come in and ask for me. It's been kind of hard. We have two stores now. We just opened up another one not too long ago, and I'm back and forth between them all the time. And it makes it hard to be in here when they want to see me.
So do you plan to defend your title?
I do.
Michael Shepherd, we want to thank you very much, and congratulations, and best luck next year.
Thank you.
Gold medal winner Michael Shepherd is the owner of Michelangelo's Pizzas in Kenton, Ohio, and in Rushylvania, Ohio.
the spinning. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
It kept on growing larger till it finally became the giant pizza.
Triple cheese!
The giant pizza. The giant pizza that ate Chicago.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Their childhood home, a parsonage on the moors of Yorkshire, England, is the second most visited literary site in the world, behind Shakespeare's Stratford. Individually, they wrote great literature, including Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. But collectively, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte have been the subjects of many more books, one of which ignited a cult craze. At one time, fans clamored for Emily Bronte soap or a small piece of one of their dresses. In this century, their stories have been told in over 50 films. Here's Laurence Olivier and Merle Oberon in the 1939 classic Wuthering Heights.
Heathcliff, make the world stop right here. Make everything stop and stand still and never move again. Make the moors never change and you and I never change.
The moors and I will never change. Don't you, Kathy?
I can't. I can't. No matter what I ever do or say, Heathcliff. This is me now, standing on this hill with you. This is me forever.
Ah, yes, the desolate, windswept moors, which, it turns out, weren't that desolate when the sisters lived there in the 1800s. In fact, the Bronte myth, which has been so embellished, really needed no embellishing. Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte all died young. Two sisters and a brother perished before them. But many feel the tragedy of the Brontes' lives has overshadowed their fiction. And the need for biographers to shape the sisters to serve their own political and cultural needs has obscured the fact that they were less victims than fiercely independent female writers at a time when that was inconceivable. Lucasta Miller has written a book called The Bronte Myth, a book about the influence of biographers. She joins us on the line from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is, do you think, the biggest Bronte myth?
Well, there are a lot of apocryphal stories that have grown up about them. Mm-hmm. But then, on the other hand, there are things about the Brontes that are, of course, true and yet have become mythic. For example, Ted Hughes, when he talks about the Brontes as being the three weird sisters, mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you know, he got the number right, he can count, there were three of them. But by making that allusion to the witches in Macbeth, he's actually appropriating the Brontes into his own mythology, rather a misogynistic one about the female artist.
And Ted Hughes, of course, the husband of Sylvia Plath.
That's right.
Who committed suicide and was also, she made the pilgrimage to the Bronte home.
She and Ted Hughes went together, actually, on their honeymoon. He actually came from that neck of the woods and was rather proud of the fact that one of his uncles had inherited some soup dishes that had once belonged to the Bronte family.
Well, let's explain that, why people were so proud of having just even a pebble from the Bronte home. And were they complicit in creating this huge following?
By the time Charlotte was 20, she was so ambitious that she actually wrote to the poet laureate, sending him some of her poetry and saying that it was her great desire to be forever known as a poet. Of course, she was rather disappointed when he wrote back saying that literature was not the business of a woman's life and should not be. Charlotte never again tried to present her literary work to the public in any way under her own name. She and her sisters, when they published their novels, chose these male pseudonyms because they believed, quite rightly, that critics were prejudiced against women authors.
They, as you said, shrouded themselves in mystery when they wrote as men, and that sort of began this sort of centuries-long, you know, trying to peel back and find out who they really are. And it was further complicated by the first biographer to write about them in what became the most famous biography of the 19th century.
You could almost say, yes, that it possibly is the most famous biography of the 19th century, Elizabeth Gaskell's Life of Charlotte Bronte, who, in fact, herself always had a rather suspicious attitude to Charlotte's novels, because although Jane Eyre had been a best-selling success, as soon as critics had begun to suspect it was by a woman, there'd been this huge critical backlash and she'd been accused of immorality. Her book was called Anti-Christian. People thought it was coarse and sort of disgusting.
Why is that? I mean, try to put us in that time if you can. Here's a line from Jane Eyre. I am no bird and no net ensnares me. I am a free human being with an independent will. Why were thoughts like that so scandalous?
Well, I do think Jane Eyre's assertiveness did upset people. It was also the fact that the Brontes used swear words and wrote about passion in a very sort of explicit way. But I think the assertiveness was one of the things that might have put off Elizabeth Gaskell, who herself was a novelist, but in a very different vein. She had a very sort of much a moral agenda when she was writing her novels. In order to sort of make sense of Charlotte, Gaskell perceived her in a light of really rather exaggerated pity. It's very interesting the way that Gaskell does it. There's one particular scene where she talks about Charlotte writing Jane Eyre and says, oh, how selfless this woman was, because in the midst of her excitement of writing this novel, she would tiptoe down to the kitchen in order to find a bowl of potatoes that the blind old servant hadn't peeled properly. And Charlotte would silently pick all the nasty bits out of the potatoes and then slide back to her desk without the servant ever finding out. Mm. Now, this, for Gaskell, was supposed to show that it was possible for a woman to be morally pure, a perfect housewife, and still write books. In subsequent biographies that followed it, the domestic icon took over so much that they'd include the story about the potatoes, but almost forget to mention that Charlotte was writing Jane Eyre at the time.
Then there was another wave in the early 1900s when it was revealed that she had written letters to a married man.
Yes, this is quite fascinating because Elizabeth Gaskell had read these letters, these passionate letters that Charlotte had written to her professor. But, of course, Gaskell couldn't possibly include them in the biography because it would go completely against the morally pure image she was trying to create. Well, in 1913, the son of the man to whom Charlotte had written the letters decided to present them to the British Museum. A lot of people got very upset. But what is interesting about the Brontes is that it has become such a personality cult. And the reason, I think, why that has happened is really down to the Gaskell biography. Because when she wrote the biography, she was using the life story almost as a way of distracting public attention from the novels, which had been attacked for being immoral. Mm. Nobody had really written a life story in quite this way before. It was so intimate, it was so domestic. There were things in it that you'd never get in a biography of a famous man at that time. You know, little things like quoting letters between Charlotte and a female friend about asking the friend to go and buy her some underwear in a shop somewhere. And so I think that from a very early stage, people felt, as one writer in the 1880s said, you know, Charlotte Bronte has come closer to me than many of my living friends. Mm.
But which is, in fact, the better story, the story of the Brontes or Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights? And
I think we've got to look at them very differently. I think you've got to see that there is a difference between biography on the one hand and literature on the other. And what's unfortunately happened a lot with the Brontes is that people have read their lives as if they were fiction, and in many cases have often fictionalized their lives. I mean, there's been a rather interesting genre of fictional biography.
Oh, there is so much in the book, as you said. It's uber biography, meta biography. Before we let you go, can you share with us what's your favorite film adaptation of one of the books?
Goodness, that's an interesting one. The BBC did an adaptation of Anne Bronte's novel, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, a few years ago, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. It's a really fascinating novel, that one, and it was actually the one that shocked their contemporaries the most when it first came out. And I think that in that adaptation, the BBC really sort of didn't sentimentalise it, which has happened so often in adaptations of the Bronte novels. I mean, the very, very famous Wuthering Heights is, in a sense, a great film, but you have to look at it compared to the novel as you would look, say, at an operatic adaptation of a book. It just loses the intellectual complexity. It really conventionalizes the love affair between Cathy and Heathcliff. I think you actually have to look at Wuthering Heights as a highly literary book. It's got nothing to do with Emily Bronte's life.
Luke Astor, thank you so much.
Oh, well, it was really nice to meet you, as it were.
Luke Astor Miller's new book is called The Bronte Myth.
Bad dreams in the night.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us your town and how to pronounce your full name. By the way, to save you the email, this is Kate Bush. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.